Dune, Cassette 6.
Book 2. Muad'Dib.
When my father, the Padishah Emperor, heard of Duke Leto's death and the manner of it, he went into such a rage as we had never before seen. He blamed my mother and the compact forced on him to place a Bene Gesserit on the throne. He blamed the guild and the evil old baron. He blamed everyone in sight, not excepting even me, for he said I was a witch like all the others. And when I sought to comfort him, saying it was done according to an older law of self-preservation to which even the most ancient rulers gave allegiance, he sneered at me and asked if I thought him a weakling. I saw then that he had been aroused to this passion not by concern over the dead duke, but by what that death implied for all royalty. As I look back on it, I think there may have been some prescience in my father too, for it is certain that his line and Muad'Dib's shared common ancestry. In my father's house by the Princess Irulan.
Now Harkonnen shall kill Harkonnen, Paul whispered. He had awakened shortly before nightfall, sitting up in a sealed and darkened still tent. As he spoke, he heard the vague stirrings of his mother where she slept against the tent's opposite wall. Paul glanced at the proximity detector on the floor, studying the dials illuminated in the blackness by phosphor tubes. It should be night soon, his mother said. Why don't you lift the tent shades? Paul realized then that her breathing had been different for some time, that she had lain silent in the darkness until certain he was awake. Lifting the shades wouldn't help, he said. There's been a storm, the tent's covered by sand. I'll dig us out soon. No sign of Duncan yet? None. Paul rubbed absently at the ducal signet on his thumb, and a sudden rage against the very substance of this planet which had helped kill his father set him trembling. I heard the storm begin, Jessica said. The undemanding emptiness of her words helped restore some of his calm. His mind focused on the storm as he had seen it begin through the transparent end of their still tent. Cold dribbles of sand crossing the basin, then runnels and tails furrowing the sky. He had looked up to a rock spire, seen it change shape under the blast, becoming a low, cheddar-colored wedge. Sand funneled into their basin had shadowed the sky with dull curry, then blotted out all light as the tent was covered. Tent bows had creaked once as they accepted the pressure, then silence, broken only by the dim bellows wheezing of their sand snorkel, pumping air from the surface. Try the receiver again, Jessica said. No use, he said. He found his stillsuit's water tube in its clip at his neck, drew a warm swallow into his mouth, and he thought that here he truly began an Arakeen existence, living on reclaimed moisture from his own breath and body. It was flat and tasteless water, but it soothed his throat. Jessica heard Paul drinking, felt the slickness of her own stillsuit clinging to her body, but she refused to accept her thirst. To accept it would require awakening fully into the terrible necessities of Arrakis, where they must guard even fractional traces of moisture, hoarding the few drops in the tent's catch pockets, begrudging a breath wasted on the open air. So much easier to drift back down into sleep. But there had been a dream in this day's sleep, and she shivered at memory of it. She had held dreaming hands beneath sand flow where a name had been written. Duke Leto Atreides. The name had blurred with the sand and she had moved to restore it, but the first letter filled before the last was begun. The sand would not stop. Her dream became wailing, louder and louder. That ridiculous wailing, part of her mind had realized the sound was her own voice as a tiny child, little more than a baby. A woman not quite visible to memory was going away. My unknown mother, Jessica thought. The Bene Gesserit who bore me and gave me to the sisters because that's what she was commanded to do. Was she glad to rid herself of a Herkonnen child? The place to hit them is in the spice, Paul said.
How can he think of attack at a time like this? She asked herself. An entire planet full of spice, she said. How can you hit them there?
She heard him stirring, the sound of their pack being dragged across the tent floor. It was sea power and air power on Caladan, he said. Here it's desert power. The Fremen are the key. His voice came from the vicinity of the tent's sphincter. Her Bene Gesserit training sensed in his tone an unresolved bitterness toward her. All his life he has been trained to hate Harkonnens, she thought. Now he finds he is Harkonnen, because of me. How little he knows me. I was my duke's only woman. I accepted his life and his values, even to defying my Bene Gesserit orders. The tent's glow tab came alight under Paul's hand, filled the domed area with green radiance. Paul crouched at the sphincter, his stillsuit hood adjusted for the open desert, forehead capped, mouth filter in place, nose plugs adjusted. Only his dark eyes were visible, a narrow band of face that turned once toward her and away. "Secure yourself for the open," he said, and his voice was blurred behind the filter. Jessica pulled the filter across her mouth, began adjusting her hood as she watched Paul break the tent seal. Sand rasped as he opened the sphincter, and a bird fizzle of grains ran into the tent before he could immobilize it with a static compaction tool. A hole grew in the sand wall as the tool realigned the grains. He slipped out, and her ears followed his progress to the surface.
"What will we find out there?" she wondered.
"Harkonnen troops and the Sardaukar, those are dangers we can expect, but what of the dangers we don't know?" She thought of the compaction tool and the other strange instruments in the pack. Each of these tools suddenly stood in her mind as a sign of mysterious dangers. She felt then a hot breeze from surface sand touch her cheeks where they were exposed above the filter. "Pass up the pack." It was Paul's voice, low and guarded. She moved to obey, heard the water leader John's gurgle as she shoved the pack across the floor. She peered upward, saw Paul framed against the stars. "Here," he said, and reached down, pulled the pack to the surface. Now she saw only the circle of stars. They were like the luminous tips of weapons aimed down at her. A shower of meteors crossed her patch of night. The meteors seemed to her like a warning, like tiger stripes, like luminous grave slats clabbering her blood. And she felt the chill of the price on their heads.
"Hurry up," Paul said. "I want to collapse the tent."
A shower of sand from the surface brushed her left hand.
"How much sand will the hand hold?" she asked herself.
"Shall I help you?" Paul asked.
"No."
She swallowed in a dry throat, slipped into the hole, felt static-packed sand rasp under her hands. Paul reached down, took her arm. She stood beside him on a smooth patch of starlit desert, stared around. Sand almost brimmed their basin, leaving only a dim lip of surrounding rock. She probed the farther darkness with her trained senses. Noise of small animals, birds. A fall of dislodged sand and faint creature sounds within it. Paul collapsing their tent, recovering it up the hole. Starlight displaced just enough of the night to charge each shadow with menace. She looked at patches of blackness.
"Black is a blind remembering," she thought. "You listen for pack sounds, for the cries of those who hunted your ancestors in a past so ancient only your most primitive selves remember. The ears see. The nostrils see."
Presently, Paul stood beside her, said, "Duncan told me that if he was captured, he could hold out this long. We must leave here now. He shouldered the pack, crossed to the shallow lip of the basin, climbed to a ledge that looked down on open desert. Jessica followed automatically, noting how she now lived in her son's orbit. "For now is my grief heavier than the sands of the seas," she thought. "This world has emptied me of all but the oldest purpose, tomorrow's life. I live now for my young Duke and the daughter yet to be." She felt the sand drag her feet as she climbed to Paul's side. He looked north across a line of rocks, studying a distant escarpment. The faraway rock profile was like an ancient battleship of the seas outlined by stars. The long swish of it lifted on an invisible wave with syllables of boomerang antennae, funnels arcing back, a pie-shaped upthrusting at the stern. An orange glare burst above the silhouette, and a line of brilliant purple cut downward toward the glare. Another line of purple, and another upthrusting orange glare. It was like an ancient naval battle, remembered shellfire, and the sight held them staring. "Pillars of fire," Paul whispered. A ring of red eyes lifted over the distant rock. Lines of purple laced the sky. "Jet flares and lace guns," Jessica said. The dust-reddened first moon of Arrakis lifted above the horizon to their left, and they saw a storm trail there, a ribbon of movement over the desert. "It must be Harkonnenthopters hunting us," Paul said. "The way they're cutting up the desert, it's as though they were making certain they stamped out whatever's there, the way you'd stamp out a nest of insects."
"Or a nest of Atreides," Jessica said.
"We must seek cover," Paul said. "We'll head south and keep to the rocks. If they caught us in the open..." He turned, adjusting the pack to his shoulders.
"They're killing anything that moves."
He took one step along the ledge and, in that instant, heard the low hiss of gliding aircraft, saw the dark shapes of ornithopters above them.
"My father once told me that respect for the truth comes close to being the basis for all morality. Something cannot emerge from nothing," he said. "This is profound thinking if you understand how unstable the truth can be." From Conversations with Muad'Dib by the Princess Irulan.
"I have always prided myself on seeing things the way they truly are," Thufir Hawat said. "That's the curse of being a Mentat. You can't stop analyzing your data."
The leathered old face appeared composed in the pre-dawn dimness as he spoke. His sappho-stained lips were drawn into a straight line with radial creases spreading upward. A robed man squatted silently on sand across from Hawat, apparently unmoved by the words. The two crouched beneath a rock overhang that looked down on a wide, shallow sink. Dawn was spreading over the shattered outline of cliffs across the basin, touching everything with pink. It was cold under the overhang, a dry and penetrating chill left over from the night. There had been a warm wind just before dawn, but now it was cold. Howard could hear teeth chattering behind him among the few troopers remaining in his force. The man squatting across from Howart was a Fremen who had come across the sink in the first light of false dawn, skittering over the sand, blending into the dunes, his movements barely discernible. The Fremen extended a finger to the sand between them, drew a figure there. It looked like a bowl with an arrow spilling out of it. "There are many Harkonnen patrols," he said. He lifted his finger, pointed upward across the cliffs that Howart and his men had descended. Howard nodded. "Many patrols, yes." But still he did not know what this Fremen wanted, and this rankled. Mentat training was supposed to give a man the power to see motives. This had been the worst night of Howard's life. He had been at Simpo, a garrison village, buffer outpost for the former capital city, Carthage, when the reports of attack began arriving. At first he'd thought, "It's a raid. The Harkonnens are testing."
But report followed report, faster and faster. 2 legions landed at Carthage. 5 legions, 50 brigades, attacking the Duke's main base at Arakin. A legion at Arsunt. 2 battle groups at Splintered Rock. Then the reports became more detailed. They were Imperial Sardaukar among the attackers, possibly 2 legions of them. And it became clear that the invaders knew precisely which weight of arms to send where. Precisely. Superb intelligence. Howart's shocked fury had mounted until it threatened the smooth functioning of his Mentat capabilities. The size of the attack struck his mind like a physical blow. Now, hiding beneath a bit of desert rock, he nodded to himself, pulled his torn and slashed tunic around him as though warding off the cold shadows. The size of the attack. He had always expected their enemy to hire an occasional lighter from the guild for probing raids. That was an ordinary enough gambit in this kind of house-to-house warfare. Lighters landed and took off on Arrakis regularly to transport the spice for House Atreides. Howard had taken precautions against random raids by false spice lighters. For a full attack, they'd expected no more than 10 brigades. But there were more than 2,000 ships down on Arrakis at the last count. Not just lighters, but frigates, scouts, monitors, crushers, troop carriers, dump boxes. More than 100 brigades. 10 legions. The entire spice income of Arrakis for 50 years might just cover the cost of such a venture. It might. I underestimated what the Baron was willing to spend in attacking us, Howard thought. I failed my Duke. Then there was the matter of the traitor. I will live long enough to see her strangled, he thought. I should have killed that Bene Gesserit witch when I had the chance. There was no doubt in his mind who had betrayed them. The Lady Jessica. She fitted all the facts available. Your man Gurney Halleck and part of his force are safe with our smuggler friends, the Fremen said. Good. So Gurney will get off this hell planet. We're not all gone. Howard glanced back at the huddle of his men. He had started the night just past with 300 of his finest. Of those, an even 20 remained, and half of them were wounded. Some of them slept now, standing up, leaning against the rock, sprawled on the sand beneath the rock. Their last thopter, the one they'd been using as a ground-effect machine to carry their wounded, had given out just before dawn. They had cut it up with laser guns and hidden the pieces, then worked their way down into this hiding place at the edge of the basin. Howard had only a rough idea of their location, some 200 kilometers southeast of Arakin. The main traveled ways between the Shield Wall Siege communities were somehow south of them. The Fremen across from Howard threw back his hood and stillsuit cap to reveal sandy hair and beard. The hair was combed straight back from a high, thin forehead. He had the unreadable total blue eyes of the spice diet. Beard and moustache were stained at one side of the mouth, his hair matted there by pressure of the looping catch tube from his nose plugs. The man removed his plugs, readjusted them. He rubbed at a scar beside his nose. "If you cross the sink here this night," the Fremen said, "you must not use shields. There is a break in the wall." He turned on his heels, pointed south. "There, and it is open sand down to the Urg. Shields will attract a..." He hesitated. "Worm. They don't often come in here, but a shield will bring one every time." He said worm, Howard thought. He was going to say something else. What? And what does he want of us? Howard sighed. He could not recall ever before being this tired. It was a muscle weariness that energy pills were unable to ease. Those damnable Sardaukar. With a self-accusing bitterness, he faced the thought of the soldier fanatics and the imperial treachery they represented. His own Mentat assessment of the data told him how little chance he had ever to present evidence of this treachery before the High Council of the Landsraad, where justice might be done.
Do you wish to go to the smugglers? The Fremen asked. Is it possible? The way is long.
Fremen don't like to say no, Idoha had told him once.
Howard said, You haven't yet told me whether your people can help my wounded.
They are wounded.
The same damned answer every time.
We know they're wounded, Howard snapped. That's not the... Peace, friend, the Fremen cautioned. What do your wounded say? Are there those among them who can see the water need of your tribe?
We haven't talked about water, Howard said.
I can understand your reluctance, the Fremen said. They are your friends, your tribesmen. Do you have water?
Not enough. The Fremen gestured to Howard's tunic, the skin exposed beneath it.
You were caught in Sirch without your suits. You must make a water decision, friend.
Can we hire your help?
The Fremen shrugged.
You have no water.
He glanced at the group behind Howard.
How many of your wounded would you spend?
Howard fell silent, staring at the man. He could see as a mentat that their communication was out of phase. Word sounds were not being linked up here in the normal manner.
I am Thufir Hawat, he said. I can speak for my duke. I will make promissory commitment now for your help. I wish a limited form of help, preserving my force long enough only to kill a traitor who thinks herself beyond vengeance.
You wish our siding in a vendetta?
The vendetta I'll handle myself. I wish to be freed of responsibility for my wounded, that I may get about it.
The Fremen scowled.
How can you be responsible for your wounded? They are their own responsibility. The water's at issue, Thufir Hawat. Would you have me take that decision away from you?
The man put a hand to a weapon concealed beneath his robe. Hawat tensed, wondering, Is there betrayal here?
What do you fear? The Fremen demanded.
These people and their disconcerting directness.
Hawat spoke cautiously.
There's a price on my head.
Ah, the Fremen removed his hand from his weapon. You think we have the Byzantine corruption.
You don't know us. The Harkonnens have not water enough to buy the smallest child among us.
But they had the price of guild passage for more than 2,000 fighting ships, Howard thought, and the size of that price still staggered him.
We both fight Harkonnens, Howard said. Should we not share the problems and ways of meeting the battle issue?
We are sharing, the Fremen said. I have seen you fight Harkonnens. You are good. There have been times I'd have appreciated your arm beside me.
Say where my arm may help you, Howard said.
Who knows? The Fremen asked. There are Harkonnen forces everywhere. But you still have not made the water decision, or put it to your wounded.
I must be cautious, Howard told himself. There's a thing here that's not understood, he said. Will you show me your way, the Arakeen way?
Stranger thinking, the Fremen said, and there was a sneer in his tone.
He pointed to the northwest across the clifftop.
We watched you come across the sand last night.
He lowered his arm.
You keep your force on the slip face of the dunes.
Bad. You have no still suits, no water. You will not last long.
The ways of Arrakis don't come easily, Howard said.
Truth, but we've killed Harkonnens.
What do you do with your own wounded? Howard demanded.
Does a man not know when he is worth saving? The Fremen asked. Your wounded know you have no water.
He tilted his head, looking sideways up at Howard.
This is clearly a time for water decision. Both wounded and unwounded must look to the tribe's future.
The tribe's future, Howard thought, the tribe of Atreides. There's sense in that. He forced himself to the question he had been avoiding.
Have you word of my duke or his son?
Unreadable blue eyes stared upward into Howard's.
Word?
Their fate, Howard snapped.
Fate is the same for everyone, the Fremen said.
Your duke, it is said, has met his fate. As to the Lisan al-Ghaib, his son, that is in Liat's hands. Liat has not said.
I knew the answer without asking, Hawat thought. He glanced back at his men. They were all awake now. They had heard. They were staring out across the sand, the realization in their expressions. There was no returning to Caladan for them. And now Arrakis was lost. Hawat turned back to the Fremen.
Have you heard of Duncan Idaho? He was in the great house when the shield went down, the Fremen said. This I've heard, no more.
She dropped the shield and let in the Harkonnens, he thought. I was the one who sat with my back to a door. How could she do this when it meant turning also against her own son? But who knows how a Bene Gesserit witch thinks, if you can call it thinking.
Hawat tried to swallow in a dry throat. When will you hear about the boy?
We know little of what happens in Arrakeen, the Fremen said. He shrugged. Who knows?
You have ways of finding out.
Perhaps.
The Fremen rubbed at the scar beside his nose.
Tell me, Thufir Hawat, do you have knowledge of the big weapons the Harkonnens used?
The artillery, Hawat thought bitterly. Who could have guessed they'd use artillery in this day of shields?
You refer to the artillery they used to trap our people in the caves, he said. I've theoretical knowledge of such explosive weapons.
Any man who retreats into a cave which has only one opening deserves to die, the Fremen said.
Why do you ask about these weapons?
Liet wishes it.
Is that what he wants from us? Hawat wondered.
He said, did you come here seeking information about the big guns?
Liet wished to see one of the weapons for himself.
Then you should just go take one, Hawat sneered.
Yes, the Fremen said, we took one. We have it hidden where Stilgar can study it for Liet, and where Liet can see it for himself, if he wishes. But I doubt he'll want to. The weapon is not a very good one. Poor design for Arrakis.
You took one? Hawat asked.
It was a good fight, the Fremen said. We lost only 2 men, and spilled the water for more than 100 of theirs.
There were Sardaukar at every gun, Hawat thought. This desert madman speaks casually of losing only 2 men against Sardaukar.
We would not have lost the 2 except for those others fighting beside the Harkonnens, the Fremen said. Some of those are good fighters.
One of Howard's men limped forward, looked down at the squatting Fremen.
Are you talking about Sardaukar?
He's talking about Sardaukar, Howard said.
Sardaukar, the Fremen said, and there appeared to be glee in his voice. Ah, so that's what they are. This was a good night indeed. Sardaukar, which legion do you know?
We don't know, Hawat said.
Sardaukar, the Fremen mused. Yet they wear Harkonnen clothing. Is that not strange?
The Emperor does not wish it known he fights against a great house, Hawat said.
But you know they are Sardaukar.
Who am I? Hawat asked bitterly.
You are Thufir Hawat, the man said matter-of-factly. Well, we would have learned it in time. We've sent 3 of them captive to be questioned by Liet's men.
Hawat's aide spoke slowly, disbelief in every word.
You captured Sardaukar?
Only 3 of them, the Fremen said. They fought well.
If only we'd had the time to link up with these Fremen, Hawat thought.
It was a sour lament in his mind.
If only we could have trained them and armed them, great mother, what a fighting force we'd have had.
Perhaps you delay because of worry over the Lisan al-Ghaib, the Fremen said. If he is truly the Lisan al-Ghaib, harm cannot touch him.
Do not spend thoughts on a matter which has not been proved.
I serve the Lisan al-Ghaib, Hawat said. His welfare is my concern. I've pledged myself to this.
You are pledged to his water?
Hawat glanced at his aide, who was still staring at the Fremen, returned his attention to the squatting figure.
To his water, yes. You wish to return to Arakeen, to the place of his water?
To the place of his water.
Why did you not say at first it was a water matter?
The Fremen stood up, seated his nose plugs firmly. Howitt motioned with his head for his aide to return to the others. With a tired shrug, the man obeyed. Howitt heard a low-voiced conversation arise among the men. The Fremen said,
"There is always a way to water."
Behind Howitt, a man cursed. Howitt's aide called, "Thufir, Arki just died." The Fremen put a fist to his ear.
"The bond of water, it's a sign."
He stared at Howitt.
"We have a place nearby for accepting the water. Shall I call my men?"
The aide returned to Howard's side, said,
"Thufir, a couple of the men left wives in Arakeen. Well, you know how it is at a time like this."
The Fremen still held his fist to his ear.
"Is it the bond of water, Thufir Hawat?" he demanded.
Howard's mind was racing. He sensed now the direction of the Fremen's words, but feared the reaction of the tired men under the rock overhang when they understood it.
"The bond of water," Hawat said.
"Let our tribes be joined," the Fremen said, and he lowered his fist.
As though that were the signal, four men slid and dropped down from the rocks above them. They darted back under the overhang, rolled the dead man in a loose robe, lifted him, and began running with him along the cliff wall to the right. Spurts of dust lifted around their running feet. It was over before Howard's tired men could gather their wits. The group with the body hanging like a sack in its enfolding robe was gone around a turn in the cliff. One of Howard's men shouted,
"Where are they going with Arki?
They're taking him to
bury him," Howard said.
"Fremen don't bury their dead," the men barked.
"Don't you try any tricks on us, Thufir. We know what they do. Arki was one of..."
"Paradise were sure for a man who died in the service of Lisan al-Ghaib," the Fremen said. "If it is the Lisan al-Ghaib you serve, as you have said it, why raise mourning cries? The memory of one who died in this fashion will live as long as the memory of man endures."
But Howard's men advanced, angry looks on their faces. One had captured a lace gun. He started to draw it.
"Stop right where you are," Howard barked.
He fought down the sick fatigue that gripped his muscles.
"These people respect our dead. Customs differ, but the meaning's the same."
"They're going to render Arki down for his water," the man with the lace gun snarled.
"Is it that your men wish to attend the ceremony?" the Fremen asked.
"He doesn't even see the problem," Howard thought. The naivete of the Fremen was frightening.
"They're concerned for a respected comrade," Howard said. "We will treat your comrade with the same reverence we treat our own," the Fremen said. "This is the bond of water. We know the rights. A man's flesh is his own. The water belongs to the tribe."
Howard spoke quickly as the man with the laser gun advanced another step.
"Will you now help our wounded?" "One does not question the bond," the Fremen said. "We will do for you what a tribe does for its own. First we must get all of you suited and see to the necessities."
The man with the laser gun hesitated. Howard's aide said, "Are we buying help with Arki's water?"
"Not buying," Howard said. "We've joined these people."
"Customs differ," one of his men muttered.
Howard began to relax.
"And they'll help us get to Arakeen?" "We will kill Harkonnens," the Fremen said.
He grinned.
"And Sardaukar."
He stepped backward, cupped his hands beside his ears, and tipped his head back, listening. Presently he lowered his hands, said,
"An aircraft comes. Conceal yourselves beneath the rock and remain motionless."
At a gesture from Hawat, his men obeyed. The Fremen took Hawat's arm,
pressed him back with the others. "We will fight in the time of fighting," the man said. He reached beneath his robes, brought out a small cage, lifted a creature from it. Hawat recognized a tiny bat. The bat turned its head, and Hawat saw its blue within blue eyes. The Fremen stroked the bat, soothing it, crooning to it. He bent over the animal's head, allowed a drop of saliva to fall from his tongue into the bat's upturned mouth. The bat stretched its wings, but remained on the Fremen's opened hand. The man took a tiny tube, held it beside the bat's head, and chattered into the tube. Then, lifting the creature high, he threw it upward. The bat swooped away beside the cliff and was lost to sight. The Fremen folded the cage, thrust it beneath his robe. Again he bent his head, listening. "They quarter the high country," he said. "One wonders who they seek up there." "It's known that we retreated in this direction," Hawat said. "One should never presume one is the sole object of a hunt," the Fremen said. "Watch the other side of the basin. You will see a thing." Time passed. Some of Howitt's men stirred, whispering. "Remain silent as frightened animals," the Fremen hissed. Hawat discerned movement near the opposite cliff, flitting blurs of tan on tan. "My little friend carried his message," the Fremen said. "He is a good messenger, day or night. I'll be unhappy to lose that one." The movement across the sink faded away. On the entire 4 to 5 kilometer expanse of sand, nothing remained but the growing pressure of the day's heat, blurred columns of rising air. "Be most silent now," the Fremen whispered. A file of plodding figures emerged from a break in the opposite cliff, headed directly across the sink. To Hawat, they appeared to be Fremen, but a curiously inept band. He counted 6 men making heavy going of it over the dunes. A thwack-thwack of ornithopter wings sounded high to the right behind Howitt's group. The craft came over the cliff wall above them, and Atreides' thopter with Harkonnen battle colors splashed on it. The thopter swooped toward the men crossing the sink. The group there stopped on a dune crest, waved. The thopter circled once over them in a tight curve, came back for a dust-shrouded landing in front of the Fremen. 5 men swarmed from the thopter, and Hawat saw the dust-repellent shimmering of shields and, in their motions, the hard competence of Sardaukar. "Aye, they use their stupid shields," the Fremen beside Hawat hissed. He glanced toward the open south wall of the sink. "They are Sardaukar," Hawat whispered. "Good." The Sardaukar approached the waiting group of Fremen in an enclosing half-circle. Sun glinted on blades held ready. The Fremen stood in a compact group, apparently indifferent. Abruptly, the sand around the 2 groups sprouted Fremen. They were at the ornithopter, then in it. Where the 2 groups had met at the dune crest, a dust cloud partly obscured violent motion. Presently, dust settled. Only Fremen remained standing. "They left only 3 men in their thopter," the Fremen beside Hawat said. "That was fortunate. I don't believe we had to damage the craft in taking it." Behind Hawat, one of his men whispered, "Those were Sardaukar." "Did you notice how well they fought?" the Fremen asked. Hawat took a deep breath. He smelled the burned dust around him, felt the heat, the dryness. In a voice to match that dryness, he said, "Yes, they fought well, indeed." The captured thopter took off with a lurching flap of wings, angled upward to the south in a steep, wing-tucked climb. "So these Fremen can handle thopters, too," Hawat thought. On the distant dune, a Fremen waved a square of green cloth. Once, twice. "More come," the Fremen beside Hawat barked. "Be ready. I'd hoped to have us away without more inconvenience." "Inconvenience?" Hawat thought. He saw two more thopters swooping from high in the west onto an area of sand suddenly devoid of visible Fremen. Only 8 splotches of blue, the bodies of the Sardaukar in Harkonnen uniforms, remained at the scene of violence. Another thopter glided in over the cliff wall above Hawat. He drew in a sharp breath as he saw it, a big troop carrier. It flew with the slow spread wing heaviness of a full load, like a giant bird coming to its nest. In the distance, the purple finger of a lace gun beam flicked from one of the diving thopters. It laced across the sand, raising a sharp trail of dust. "The cowards!" the Fremen beside Hawat rasped. The troop carrier settled toward the patch of blue-clad bodies. Its wings crept out to full reach, began the cupping action of a quick stop. Howard's attention was caught by a flash of sun on metal to the south, a thopter plummeting there in a power dive, wings folded flat against its sides, its jets a golden flare against the dark, silvered gray of the sky. It plunged like an arrow toward the troop carrier, which was unshielded because of the lasergun activity around it. Straight into the carrier, the diving thopter plunged. A flaming roar shook the basin. Rocks tumbled from the cliff walls all around. A geyser of red-orange shot skyward from the sand where the carrier and its companion thopters had been, everything there caught in the flame. "It was the Fremen who took off in that captured thopter," Hawat thought. "He deliberately sacrificed himself to get that carrier. Great Mother! What are these Fremen?" "A reasonable exchange," said the Fremen beside Hawat. "There must have been 300 men in that carrier. Now we must see to their water and make plans to get another aircraft." He started to step out of their rock-shadowed concealment. A rain of blue uniforms came over the cliff wall in front of him, falling in low suspenser slowness. In the flashing instant, Hawat had time to see that they were Sardaukar, hard faces set in battle frenzy, that they were unshielded and each carried a knife in one hand, a stunner in the other. A thrown knife caught Hawat's Fremen companion in the throat, hurling him backward, twisting face down. Hawat had only time to draw his own knife before blackness of a stunner projectile felled him.
Muad'Dib could indeed see the future, but you must understand the limits of this power. Think of sight. You have eyes, yet cannot see without light. If you are on the floor of a valley, you cannot see beyond your valley. Just so, Muad'Dib could not always choose to look across the mysterious terrain. He tells us that a single obscure decision of prophecy, perhaps the choice of one word over another, could change the entire aspect of the future. He tells us, "The vision of time is broad, but when you pass through it, time becomes a narrow door." And always he fought the temptation to choose a clear, safe course, warning, "That path leads ever down into stagnation." From Arrakis Awakening by the Princess Irulan.
As the ornithopters glided out of the night above them, Paul grabbed his mother's arm, snapped, "Don't move." Then he saw the lead craft in the moonlight, the way its wings cupped to break for landing, the reckless dash of the hands at the controls. "It's Idaho," he breathed. The craft and its companions settled into the basin like a covey of birds coming to nest. Idaho was out of his thopter and running toward them before the dust settled. 2 figures in Fremen robes followed him. Paul recognized one, the tall, sandy-bearded Kynes. "This way," Kynes called, and he veered left. Behind Kynes, other Fremen were throwing fabric covers over their ornithopters. The craft became a row of shallow dunes. Idaho skidded to a stop in front of Paul, saluted. "My lord, the Fremen have a temporary hiding place nearby where we..." "What about that back there?" Paul pointed to the violence above the distant cliff, the jet flares, the purple beams of laser guns lacing the desert. A rare smile touched Idaho's round, placid face. "My lord, sire, I've left them a little, sir..." Glaring white light filled the desert, bright as a sun, etching their shadows onto the rock floor of the ledge. In one sweeping motion, Idaho had Paul's arm in one hand, Jessica's shoulder in the other, hurling them down off the ledge into the basin. They sprawled together in the sand as the roar of an explosion thundered over them. Its shockwave tumbled chips off the rock ledge they had vacated. Idaho sat up, brushed sand from himself.
"Not the family atomics," Jessica said. "I thought..."
"You planted a shield back there," Paul said. "A big one turned to full force," Idaho said. "A laser gun beam touched it and..." He shrugged.
"Subatomic fusion," Jessica said. "That's a dangerous weapon."
"Not weapon, m'lady. Defense. That scum will think twice before using laser guns another time."
The Fremen from the ornithopters stopped above them. One called in a low voice,
"We should get under cover, friends."
Paul got to his feet as Idaho helped Jessica up.
"That blast will attract considerable attention, sire," Idaho said.
"Sire," Paul thought. The word had such a strange sound when directed at him. Sire had always been his father. He felt himself touched briefly by his powers of prescience, seeing himself infected by the wild race consciousness that was moving the human universe toward chaos. The vision left him shaken, and he allowed Idaho to guide him along the edge of the basin to a rock projection. Fremen there were opening a way down into the sand with their compaction tools.
"May I take your pack, sire?"
Idaho asked.
"It's not heavy, Duncan," Paul said. "You have no body shield," Idaho said. "Do you wish mine?"
He glanced at the distant cliff.
"Not likely there'll be any more laser gun activity about."
"Keep your shield, Duncan. Your right arm is shield enough for me." Jessica saw the way the praise took effect. How Idaho moved closer to Paul, and she thought, "Such a sure hand my son has with his people." The Fremen removed a rock plug that opened a passage down into the native basement complex of the desert. A camouflage cover was rigged for the opening.
"This way," one of the Fremen said, and he led them down rock steps into darkness.
Behind them, the cover blotted out the moonlight. A dim green glow came alive ahead, revealing the steps and rock walls, a turn to the left. Robed Fremen were all around them now, pressing downward. They rounded the corner, found another down-slanting passage. It opened into a rough cave chamber. Kine stood before them, Jebba hood thrown back, the neck of his stillsuit glistening in the green light. His long hair and beard were mussed. The blue eyes, without whites, were a darkness under heavy brows. In the moment of encounter, Kynes wondered at himself. "Why am I helping these people? It's the most dangerous thing I've ever done. It could doom me with them." Then he looked squarely at Paul, seeing the boy who had taken on the mantle of manhood, masking grief, suppressing all except the position that now must be assumed, the dukedom. And Kynes realized in that moment the dukedom still existed, and solely because of this youth. And this was not a thing to be taken lightly. Jessica glanced once around the chamber, registering it on her senses in the Bene Gesserit way, a laboratory, a civil place full of angles and squares in the ancient manner. "This is one of the Imperial ecological testing stations my father wanted as advance bases," Paul said.
"His father wanted," Kynes thought.
And again Kynes wondered at himself, "Am I foolish to aid these fugitives? Why am I doing it? It'd be so easy to take them now, to buy the Harkonnen trust with them." Paul followed his mother's example, gestalting the room, seeing the workbench down one side, the walls of featureless rock. Instruments lined the bench, dials glowing, wire grid-X planes with fluting glass emerging from them. An ozone smell permeated the place. Some of the Fremen moved on around a concealing angle in the chamber, and new sounds started there. Machine coughs, the whinnies of spinning belts and multi-drives. Paul looked to the end of the room, saw cages with small animals in them stacked against the wall.
"You've recognized this place correctly," Kynes said. "For what would you use such a place, Paul Atreides?"
"To make this planet a fit place for humans,"
Paul said. Perhaps that's why I help them. Kynes thought. The machine sounds abruptly hummed away to silence. Into this void there came a thin animal squeak from the cages. It was cut off abruptly as though in embarrassment. Paul returned his attention to the cages, saw that the animals were brown-winged bats. An automatic feeder extended from the side wall across the cages. A Fremen emerged from the hidden area of the chamber, spoke to Kynes. Yet the field generator equipment is not working. I am unable to mask us from proximity detectors. Can you repair it? Kynes asked. Not quickly. The parts. The man shrugged. Yes, Kynes said. Then we'll do without machinery. Get a hand pump for air out to the surface. Immediately, the man hurried away. Kynes turned back to Paul. You have a good answer. Jessica marked the easy rumble of the man's voice. It was a royal voice, accustomed to command. And she had not missed the reference to him as Liet. Liet was the Fremen alter ego, the other face of the tame planetologist. We're most grateful for your help, Dr. Kynes, she said.
We'll see, Kynes said. He nodded to one of his men. Spice coffee in my quarters, Shamir.
At once, Liet, the man said. Kynes indicated an arched opening in the side wall of the chamber. If you please. Jessica allowed herself a regal nod before accepting. She saw Paul give a hand signal to Idaho, telling him to mount guard here. The passage, 2 paces deep, opened through a heavy door into a square office lighted by golden glow globes. Jessica passed her hand across the door as she entered, was startled to identify Plasteel. Paul stepped 3 paces into the room, dropped his pack to the floor. He heard the door close behind him, studied the place. About 8 meters to a side, walls of natural rock, curry-colored, broken by metal filing cabinets on their right. A low desk with milk-glass top shot full of yellow bubbles occupied the room's center. 4 suspensor chairs ringed the desk.